Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Jeanies, you're back. You just can't stay away. Well, welcome to Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and like Hans and Franz of the old Saturday Night Live sketch, I am here to pump you up in your family history research. And that's why we say we're here to shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And everyone has a few of those. Well, maybe not as many as I do. Anyway, we want to welcome another great radio station to our growing network of Extreme Jeans affiliates. 1230 AM KELY in Ely, Nevada. We're proud to be part of Fred Weinberg's and Wyatt Cox's outstanding weekend lineup. Our guest this week, the first starting in about 10 minutes, is a frequent visitor to the show, Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com. He'll be talking about the Great Fire of 1871. And it's not the one you think. Did it affect your ancestral family? Stan will fill us in. Then, later in the show, Jen Allen from FamilySearch.org joins us to update us on what's going on with the worldwide phenomenon known as Roots Tech. It's coming up on us fast. If you're not familiar with it, you'll want to be. If you are familiar with it, you'll want to hear the latest news for this year's number one family history conference. It's going to be a lot of fun. There's going to be a lot to be learned, and you should make plans to be there. Jen will bring us up to speed. And Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, is back to answer your questions to make sure your family treasures of all kinds, audio, video, home movies, written, slides, photos, survive to continue to enrich future generations of your family. Our Extreme Jeans poll this week asked the question, do you have someone in your family who was named for someone famous? 62% of you answered this question with a yes. And I will make a guess that many of those had at least one forebearer named George Washington something. My family had at least two of those, an Andrew Jackson, an Isaac Newton, and two Winfield Scott Hancocks. Now, it took me a while to learn that he was a well-known guy back in the day. Hancock, a Civil War general of great note, ran against Garfield for president in 1880 and lost, which, since Garfield was later assassinated, was too bad for both men. Both my grandfather and my uncle were given this name. They may count twice, by the way, since Hancock was named for Winfield Scott, a general from the War of 1812. You know, naming a child for someone famous often says a lot about the interests of the parents, especially if the name is from the world of politics. I mean, would a Republican really name a child for a famous Democrat? And I bet you know at least one person named Lisa Marie, born in the 1960s. Thank you very much. It is time once again for our family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeJeans.com. Family history was made this past week in Chicago, where daredevil Nick Walenda, without benefit of harness or safety net, walked on high wires between skyscrapers 600 feet above the streets of downtown Chicago. I mean, the whole thing was carried live on Discovery Channel, which used a 10-second delay in the event of any, shall we say, unpleasantry that may have occurred. Of course, it didn't. Nick set two world records in doing this, walking a high wire between three skyscrapers, with each being higher than the Washington Monument. On one leg, Walenda walked on a steep incline, and on another, he was blindfolded. His biggest concern? Wind, of course. Where does the family history fit into this? Well, Nick, who is 35, is the great-grandson of Carl Walenda, who created the famous Flying Walendas, described as a circus family. Carl died at the age of 73 back in 1978. Yes, from a fall from a tightrope between a couple of buildings in Puerto Rico. So experience doesn't always matter in their line of work. Even Nick's mother, Delilah, was 6 months along with Nick when she walked the tightrope. Back in 2012, Nick set a record crossing Niagara Falls from the U.S. to Canada. You don't see tightrope walker in a lot of census records. You notice that? Hopefully, the Walenda family continues to create many more of those and not so many early death certificates. Well, imagine hearing that your family member was already fighting World War II before December 7th, 1941. Tom Ellsworth, the son of a one-time FBI agent named James Ellsworth, has contributed fascinating information from his father's journal and letters for a new Scribner book called Double Agent, The First Hero of World War II and How the FBI Outwitted and Destroyed a Nazi Spy Ring. The author, Peter Duffy, was given access to James Ellsworth's papers to put together a timeline to this fascinating story. It began in early 1940. The Ellsworth family was living in Huntington Park, California. James received a message from J. Edgar Hoover to report to New York City, where two other agents met him. On the way into the city from the airport, the other agents took away James' gun, his ID, everything, and gave him credentials under a new name. He was then taken to and introduced to a man named William S. Siebold, who had been born in Germany. Siebold was the first double agent in the history of the FBI. Ellsworth had served a Mormon mission in the same German town in which Siebold had been born, and on that day became Siebold's handler. Within 16 months, 33 Nazi spies were arrested in what is still considered the biggest case of espionage in the history of the United States. Tom Ellsworth had kept his father's journals and letters written by his father to his mother for family history purposes. It was when author Peter Duffy came along that the Ellsworths knew that their father's story was in good hands, and they allowed him unlimited access to the materials that gave Duffy a timeline to the events involving James Ellsworth, who was truly one of the first Americans to fight for his country in World War II. There's another great argument, by the way, for keeping your ancestors' letters and diaries for future generations. Find out more about both of these great stories at ExtremeGenes.com. And that is your Family Histoire News for this week. And coming up next, we call him Stan the Man. Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com returns to tell us about the Great Fire of 1871. And it is not the one you think it is. Most families have been affected by fire at one time or another in their history, but few had the impact of this one. We'll tell you about it in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with my guest Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com. Welcome back, Stan. Good to see you again.
It's great to be back, Fish.
Hey, we're talking fires today, and I think a lot of family histories have been affected by fires, especially in large urban areas. I know mine did with various fires in New York City, 1835, during the Revolutionary War was another one. And then you were telling me about the Great Fire of 1871. And, of course, I immediately think, Chicago.
Which happens to be a reasonably great one.
The fire of 1871?
Same day, same everything.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There were multiple fires.
But before
we go to that fire, can we talk about another fire?
Sure.
You know, people like to cook their turkeys, and if Mr. Franklin Roosevelt had his way, you'd be doing it on a different day.
What day would we be doing it on?
You would be doing it on the second to the last Thursday of the month.
As opposed to the last. Right.
Because in 1939, there were five Thursdays in the month, the last being on the 30th. Well, the retail lobby was not thrilled.
Oh.
Yeah, you got the idea.
Yep.
Yeah, we don't have enough days for Christmas shopping, so Mr. Roosevelt changed it to the second.
Well.
To please him. But it wasn't a federal law or federal holiday at the time, and so some governors changed and some did not. And so about half and half, when it came time for the cutting of the turkey, half went with Mr. Roosevelt and half went with
the governor.
The old traditional last Thursday. And so as a result, the second Thursday became known as Franksgiving. Yeah, and I'm not kidding. There was a little tidbit in the newspaper, a little ditty that went, "Happy Thanksgiving to you. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Happy Franksgiving, dear misguided, who chose today. Happy Franksgiving to you."
Now this is important because in the 30s, there, as I recall, there seemed to be a little economic trouble going on.
You might put it that way.
Yeah. I probably would have sided with Frank to go with the earlier one.
Yeah, there wasn't a problem with many people getting a turkey to cook. They did chicken or bologna or something.
Sure.
What would that do for Black Friday?
I don't know. Let's not even go there.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you.
I want to hear about this fire in 1871 now.
Well, in the process of looking for meat to put on the bones of my own genealogy.
Right. Creating stories.
Exactly. The stories to go around them. My mother's family, part of them lived in Holland, Michigan. And I've been to Holland many times from the time of my youth up until just a couple years ago. wonderful little town, Dutch community. But I'd always noticed that there was a very radical difference between the architecture of the college in Holland and the rest of the community. And I got doing some digging, and I found out that on October 8th, 1871, all of Holland burned to the ground.
Now, that's the same day as the Chicago
fire.
That's
the exact same day as the Chicago fire, both of them starting on October 8th, as did the Peshtigo fire in Wisconsin near, yeah, I know, you're shaking your
head. What?
The who? The Peshtigo.
Okay.
It's a community close to Green Bay. In Chicago, the fire consumed about 3 square miles of property.
And this was the cow that tipped over.
Actually, there was a reporter in 1898 who confessed to making up the story about Mrs. O'Leary's cow. Sadly, there were 300 people killed in the Chicago fire.
Right.
In the Peshtigo fire, there were in excess of 1,500 people killed.
Oh, my.
Entire towns burned to the ground. People spent the night standing in Lake Michigan in October, up to their neck in water, trying to avoid being burned to death. It was a hellacious inferno. Personal accounts talk about it as a hurricane of fire. And within about 30 minutes, the town of Peshtigo, the fire started and it was gone in about 30 minutes.
Wow. What fueled this and what started it?
What started it was, and it contributed to the Chicago fire, was that in 1870 and throughout 1871, there had been a historic drought in the Midwest. And then there was a major low-pressure system that moved in that brought with it great winds. Well, in the northern parts of Wisconsin, where Peshtigo is, and around Holland, Michigan, and Manistee, and Port Huron, it was greatly forested, and there was a lot of lumbering being done. And as they cut the trees, they didn't do as they do today. They did not clean out the brush. They left it behind. Also, that time of year, the farmers were, the normal practice was to burn their fields to clear
sure.
any weeds. And
as it still is in many places.
Well, the winds picked up and caught hold of these fires, and they just went raging through the area. The Chicago fire, as I said, consumed 3 square miles. The Great Michigan Fires, it's called, because there were several communities around Holland that were consumed. It took 3,900 square miles.
Whoa.
Yeah.
3,900 square miles.
2.5 million acres.
Unbelievable.
Peshtigo, they thought it was probably around 1,500 square miles.
So we lost 1,500 people, 1,500 square miles in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
300 people and 3 square miles in Chicago.
And
in
another
Holland.
Another 1,500 that they know of in the Great Michigan Fire. But they figure that in 1870, there was a very large number, N71, there were a very large number of salesmen and lumberjacks that were in the forest and in the small communities that were in the forest for whom they have no way of accounting
right.
for these people. So there are guesses that it could go as high as 3,000 people that lost their lives.
So was it thought that October 8th, 1871, all three of these major area fires maybe started from the same cause, the same low-pressure system?
Interesting you should ask, because there was a crackpot out there. His theory was that a massive meteor had come and split off and had gone into these places on fire. Now, the reality is that there's not been one fire ever reported throughout recorded history where a meteor had started a fire.
Right.
But it sure did, excuse me, catch fire in the media.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that, you know, so many records, I mean, in Chicago, when you go to look for records, you're kind of up the creek when you get back to 1871 and before. In around Peshtigo, the same problem. But in Holland, it was interesting because some really quick-thinking Dutchman grabbed all of the records and they buried them in the sand on the beaches of Lake Michigan. After the fire was over, they went back to dig them out, and there was a glaze of glass on the surface of the sand.
Oh, because it had been so hot.
It had been that hot.
And yet it protected the records.
It protected the records. Some of them were scorched a bit, but it protected them sufficiently enough that they have them even today. There are many personal accounts of the fires and the people standing in water, as I said, up to their neck, and the smoke and the ash and the dust being so thick that they could not breathe, or they were trying to get to the water, and they would just be overcome with all the stuff that was in the air. And they would be in the water, and they would have to dip their heads to clear the stuff off their face. But even having done that, there were about half of them that their faces were severely burned being out in the water. It was so, so very, very hot.
So are there lists now of those who were lost in Chicago, lost in Wisconsin, lost in Michigan on that
yeah,
day?
Yeah, there are lists of people who are given in newspapers listed as missing.
Right.
If it was my family, I'm looking for my wife and my children. Or there are lists of bodies that have been identified. A great number of the bodies that were found could not be identified because the entire family had been wiped out. And there's one case of a father with several small children who is just yards away from the lake, and he's got them in embrace when they were consumed by the fire. Yeah, there are lists that are available, but they are by no means complete lists, but you can look for them. In 38 years, I've never had anyone who I've looked for that was a victim of the fire that I know of.
Right.
It could be that in looking at the standard vital records that it just doesn't show up because there was no one to record it.
Right.
And so you don't know.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Yeah.
And you think back on some of the family trees that we come across. If you have that date, October 8th, 1871, somewhere in the region.
8th, 9th, and 10th.
8th, 9th, and
10th. Days.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Oh, it gets better. The Thumb of Michigan in 1881, it was consumed again.
10 years later.
10 years later.
If you have this date and you only have your data, you might want to find out what was going on there at that time, because your people may have been a part of this. And this is the important part of knowing the stories of what's going on in a place and a particular time.
Yeah, it's not unique to Chicago and Wisconsin and Michigan. It happened all over. It's something we don't see anymore because of the change of materials that are used, the zoning rules, fire escapes, alarms, all that kind of thing. There are still massive fires, but nothing on the scale of this. In thinking about it, though, it was the Chicago fire that took Chicago from being a backwater place into being a modern, thriving city after the fact. And it resurrected, you know, did the Phoenix thing, much like London did in 1666.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Stan Lindis, thanks so much. There was more than one fire, October 8th, 1871.
Yeah, and the other one was the Chicago fire.
Great stuff. Thanks so much for joining us. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Tom, welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
And I'm excited. Every time you show up, you seem to have some new technology to tell us about, and today is no exception.
Technology is just absolutely so crazy. I just can't believe how fast things are coming down the pipe. You know, we've talked on past shows about how things are every like 5 to 7 years, they would double. Now it's down even more than that. A year ago, back in 2013, we had to update our slide scanner 3 times because of new technology. We have a lot of people that write us that have problems with discs. They've been scratched or gouged. And it's not just because you don't take care of them. Sometimes in players, that can happen
right
to them. And so I want to kind of share some tips and tricks of how to take care of your discs before they get scratched. Once you're past that point and you have scratched or gouged discs, what we can do to try and save them. There's some different options. One of the things that we're going to talk about a little bit and follow up on it in a few weeks is there's a new polymer out. And the interesting thing, this has been developed by a friend of mine, and they do stainless steel restoration on fridges and things like that.
Okay.
And they have found out he had some CDs that were scratched. And I thought, oh, let me see what it does on this. And it fixed them.
Really?
Without any kind of abrasion or anything, because you know you can't scratch stainless steel or it's ruined.
Of course.
And so he found out it's a special kind of a polymer, and they're working on retail packaging right now. And he's going to drop some by for me this week to test out and try it on some DVDs, Blu-rays, CDs, and see how well it works. So in the next few weeks, you know, I'll return and report, so to speak, on it and see how it's going. Because the biggest problem with scratch is what causes it not to be able to read. It's not really the scratch per se itself. It's the light that's penetrating through the bottom side of the disc. When it hits a scratch, it fractures the light. Just like when you put a prism up to the sun, it fractures it into, you know, the red, green, blue, violet.
Right.
And so what it's doing is it's not reading it very good. It's almost like putting on dirty glasses. Your eyes are still the same. They can see fine, but everything's kind of foggy because you have dirty glasses on. And that's basically what a scratch is in a CD or a DVD or a Blu-ray disc. So when the light hits this and fractures, it's not sure if this is a zero or a one. Now, back in the day when we used to have Walkmans that we would carry around CD players on our hips and they would shake a lot, they built in more what they call oversampling, where it would go and say, okay, here's a whole bunch of zeros, here's a whole bunch of ones. It would find a pattern. And so if it says, oh, I can't read this one, but based on this pattern, I'm going to assume this is a zero, so I'm going to put the zero in there. And 90% of the time, it was right on. Sometimes you might hear a little skip. But nowadays, since the machines are better, they have better stabilizers in them, they don't use that technology. And why, I have no idea. They have just stopped using it. So you don't have that much of overscan. So when you have a scratch and it doesn't oversample, it has no idea what to do. And unfortunately, some of the cheaper brands, when it doesn't know what to do, it just freezes and stops. And so your DVD or your CD just stops playing, nothing's going on, and you might hear a brrrr type sound.
That's a terrible sound.
Yeah, and it doesn't know what to do. Where the ones that oversample will try and figure out, okay, this is what it needs to be, here's where we need to go. Some of the smarter technology on DVD and CD players will say, I have no clue what to do, but I'm not going to sit here, I'm going to go to the next one. Basically, if you have one that is a kind of a smart player, they'll say, hey, I don't know what's here, I'm going to just skip over this. You'll hear kind of a blurp or something like that, or you'll see one if it's a video, and it'll go past that, and then at least it'll keep playing on. Where the cheaper ones, you know, you're stuck, you have to hit eject, take the disc out, put it back in, etc. And in the next segment, we'll go into a little bit more detail of how you can take care of these and hopefully remove some of these scratches at home or send them in to us.
We'll get into that coming up next in 3 minutes on Extreme Jeans, Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com. We are back. Final segment of Extreme Jeans, Family History Radio, America's Family History Show for this week. Fisher here with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, the Preservation Authority. Last segment, we were talking about a new discovery, some kind of new thing that you put on your disc, Tom, to make sure it's repaired properly, it can read the light. And yet there are other ways people can actually save their discs right now if there's a problem. Now, what are those?
The easiest, simplest thing to do, of course, is send us your discs because we can repair them. We can even do gouges that are in the back quite often.
How is that? How do you do that?
Well, what we do is we have a 5-stage sanding process, just like if you have a piece of fine furniture that has got old and has nicks and it's been like weathered and such. We use these 5 different stages of sandpaper. We can actually use 6 if they're really bad gouges. And what we're doing is we're taking off the thin layers of the back side of the DVD or CD, which is the side, like I mentioned before, where it reads from. Even though the data is towards the top, it reads it from the back. So depending on how deep the scratch is, we sand it down. And the best way to tell how deep your scratch is just use your finger. If you run your finger over it and you can just barely feel it, you know, that's usually a stage 5, what we call it. If you run your fingernail over it and it actually stops in the gouge, it doesn't like skip over it, that's a level 6. And those are pretty bad. When those are in some game discs, especially the little Nintendo, the little round ones,
right?
The polycarbonate on those is so thin, we recommend you don't ever do that. When people bring those in that are gouged, what we tell the people is, hey, we can try it. If it ruins your disc, it won't play anyway. Do you want to take the gamble? And most people say, well, yeah, because otherwise I throw it away.
Right.
And we've been able to recover some. The best thing to do is send them to us, and we can fix those. And people always ask what the cost is. Walk-in customers, it's usually about $5 to $10 a disc, depending how bad it is. We do them for libraries where it's as little as $1. So if you send us an entire spindle of 50 discs, it's only going to be like $1 a piece. And then we'll resurface them. If you don't want to deal with that, you want to do it yourself. The biggest warning I can give to you is do not use these machines that you buy in the stores unless you know what you're doing. We get so many discs in that people have tried to do that, and they've actually damaged their disc more.
Huh.
Because what happens is they get dry, they don't use enough liquid in them, and when you're doing this thing, what it does, it kind of spins the disc around, and it can actually scratch them, do more damage to it. I've had people load them in upside down accidentally, totally nuke their disc because they got into the layer where the metallic is, like tinfoil as I refer to it, and ruin the disc. So I really recommend you don't use those. There are some good products on the market, like this polymer that I've told you about in the first segment. Within the next few weeks, it should be ready for packaging and selling coast to coast. And we'll put it on our website as well. So if you want to buy that, that should work really well. One thing you always want to remember is whenever you're cleaning a disc, start at the hole and work straight out. Don't clean it like you would a record, because what happens is if you have a little piece of grit in there and you're doing it like you would clean a record and it starts scratching and it makes a radial scratch, those ones are really, really bad, because when the laser's reading it, it's going to read that radial scratch for a whole inch and have no idea what to do. Whereas if you have that same scratch, but it's going from the center out, you've got this little teeny thin part that might take up two or three little zeros or ones. So hopefully there's going to be enough overscan in your device to go over it and read what it's supposed to be. That's why you always want to clean it from inside out. Don't use household chemicals. The only thing I would ever use that's not specifically made to clean CDs is you can use like dishwashing detergent. Not what would go in a dishwasher, but the ones that you could use hand washing dishes. And just put a little teeny bit on that. Use a lint-free cloth. Don't use Kleenex. Don't use toilet paper. Don't use anything that can hold dust and such, because that will scratch your disc. So the best thing to do is run it under a lot of water, get as much stuff off as you can, and then wash it from the inside out, and hopefully that'll take care of it. Don't use toothpaste.
Okay. I will not use toothpaste. He's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. Thanks, Tom. See you again next week.
We'll see you then.
Thanks also to Stan Lindis from HeritageConsulting.com for his stories about the great fires of 1871. And to Jen Allen from FamilySearch.org for filling us in on the latest with Roots Tech. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.